5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
How about we do it again?
6, 7, 4, 3, 2, 1. I think I got it.
Okay, let's try one more time.
I definitely did.
Why can't we move you?
Why can't we move you?
Say six.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hello and welcome. You have found your way to the 280th episode of Rank and Review. And it will be delicious food to pour into your ears. For this episode, we are talking about action classics. And by we, I mean myself, your host and random Canadian Larry Parsons, and my sons, Owen and Tristan Parsons, ever the best enterprise I've ever undertaken in my life, are my boys. And we do a movie night once a week in our house, so I fed them a rich diet of classic action for them to, you know, feed their imaginations. But a movie night came along where their mother wasn't going to be around, and it was just us boys. And Owen decided, or asked me, that instead of watching a movie, if maybe we could finally record this podcast. No, I didn't have to pester my boys, or bully them, or make them do it like a chore. My boys wanted to record a podcast with me, and don't it just bring a tear to the damn eye? So, out of respect to them being so respectful to me and enjoying doing the podcast, I've just decided to try to watch my goddamn mouth this episode. Oh, shit. I'll re-record that. I'll edit that out. The point is, my sons, Owen and Tristan Parsons, are back on the show. And they're going to help me talk about six what I think are action movies that deserve classic status for one reason or another. But how will they rank? Well, you can send your feedback to me at rankandreview@gmail.com. That's RANKNREVIEW @gmail.com. You can check out the website at rankandreview.ca. There's also a presence on YouTube, although not a lot of traffic there. So if you were to drop your ranks under some of the podcasts or throw a like, subscribe, or a comment under one of the reviews, it would help traffic. I would actually see it and read it, and I would appreciate you. But, you know, I don't want to be a bully. I'm not like that. I don't want to sound needy. I want to talk about action movies and gunfights and explosions with my sons. And I want to make everybody who's listening understand. We're going to talk spoilers, and there's probably going to be some coarse language. But I'm going to try and be good. Do love those boys. Yes, there may be some hum from the air conditioning, but it's minus 34 degrees out, so we're just going to do it. We're going to deal. My boys are back on the podcast. Owen, Tristan.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
All grown up, young men now, but every episode we can hear you guys ringing in the new episode of Rank and Review. As the amazing and responsible parent that I am, I raised you on a diet of action movies.
Mm-hmm. As one does.
As one does. So, like, you saw Die Hard at a pretty young age. And
yeah.
We were watching things like The Rock, and I was showing you some of my nostalgic action picks and other things.
Mm-hmm.
I forced the Muppets on you guys. I
yeah. Mm-hmm. And we thank you for those.
That's just responsible parenting. So what we're going to do today is we're going to do a list of action movies. But usually on Rank and Review, I like to sort of have a spectrum. There's like a couple of obviously pretty great movies, a couple of, you know, almost some people like it, some people hate it, and then maybe a couple lower brow movies. I think that we have here a pretty solid collection of action movies, and that, at least in my humble opinion, there are zero duds.
Mm-hmm.
This makes it hard for the rank because, A, the quality of the films, and it also dilutes other would-be rank and review episodes because, you know, usually we spread the classics out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know that I would call every movie on this list a classic, but it is not without classics.
Yeah, like, it was really hard for me to make up my mind for a lot of these.
The top two is brutal.
Yeah.
The top two is brutal. And I apologize as your father, and I never apologize to you little bastards, but I apologize as your father to put you through that horrifying decision. But, okay, I'll start with Tristan. You love the action genre. I know we're John Wick free here, but what do you want out of your action movie? What are you basing your scale on here?
Yeah. Well, for me, it's, like, various different things, like, one thing is, like, sort of, like, story-wise, like, does sort of, like, is there an interesting, sort of, like, premise to the story itself? And, like, you know, the action and, like, the fight, like, well, fight scenes are just, like, general, like, action-y scenes, like, how well they play out and stuff and like
giving
that.
Giving us a reason to care about the action.
Yeah.
You can have really cool special effects, but it's even cooler if we understand why they're happening and care about who they're happening to.
Yeah.
What do you like out of your action movies, Owen?
Similar to Tristan, I like the characters of these action movies and how these plots sort of focus on a main guy going through the most difficult part of their life.
Yeah.
These are... A lot of these people are slightly more experienced people, but a lot of them are like army dudes, cops. Like, these are people that are used to high stress scenarios, but this is something new. I agree with Tristan when I say that combat is important, but as much as I love giant gruesome murders and explosions, I do need a story and I do need to care, and I also need the movie to take itself seriously in a way that it's not like la-di-da, I'm so important. I guess my word is consistent. I need to not feel robbed at any point.
Right.
Even though these action movies are inherently unrealistic to hell.
But they need to be real within their own world.
Yes.
They can bend the rules, they can stretch credulity, but, like, yeah, on this canvas, yeah. You don't want us to be thinking, like, yeah, right, this is crazy, this is stupid. No, you want to be empathizing with what's going on.
I don't want some guy to get shot through the stomach and live, but someone gets punched so hard, they die instantly.
Right. There's a, yeah.
Yeah.
Respect our intelligence, at least minimally, even though these are sort of fun, dumb entertainments. Also, I think there's another style of action that's not being represented here. This is sort of your shoot 'em up kind of one guy against a small army type of action movie. Another time that we might even discuss someday, if you guys like, is like a martial arts action movie where it's...
Which we also love.
Yeah. But in that case, I think you can get away with a little bit less story and more sort of... Because we're there for the... amazing acrobatics and like the it's almost like a musical, but the instead of the songs and the big numbers, they're just incredible fight sequences.
And to me, a bit of that sacrifice is the actual raw effort it would take to perform these actions.
And they're not necessarily real, but man, are they real entertaining.
Like, it's funny, you like push the like envelope of what's realistically possible a bit, or like even a bit more for stuff like, well, like it's not on this like John Wick, it series like famously is not really that grounded in reality,
but it has its own reality that we respect more or less. One fall off a building more or less. That's a pretty good introduction, don't you think?
Within this skyscraper high above the city, 12 terrorists have declared war.
They're about to be taught a lesson in the real use of power.
They're as brilliant.
Because I am interested in the $640 million in your vault.
as they are ruthless.
But I'm telling you, you're just gonna have to kill me.
Okay. We do it the hard way.
Now, the last thing McLean wants...
Think, damn it, think!
...is to be a hero.
Where's Holly?
Hey, Tucker!
Where?
But he doesn't have a choice.
What does he think he's doing?
Job.
They have already killed one hostage.
This channel is reserved for emergency calls only.
Lady, do I sound like I'm wearing a pizza?
He's inside? Who is he?
Who are you then?
You are most troublesome for a security guard.
Sorry, wrong guess, huh? Would you like to go for double jeopardy?
So once upon a time, there was a movie called Die Hard.
I like the story.
John McTiernan is the director. He's coming off of a little movie called Predator. You guys know a movie called Predator?
Once or twice.
I've heard of it, yeah.
We may have seen it a few dozen times. Okay. Well, a lot of people didn't see this coming, and a lot of big names said no to this movie because they were doing something different. This was still the 80s, but this was the era of Sylvester Stallone, who we're going to talk about later, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, who we're also going to talk about later, just owning everything. And they played these huge, muscle-bound guys who were indestructible and just got shit done. They were just an unstoppable, immovable, action hero. And what they consciously tried to do with John McClane is make somebody who is vulnerable and relatable and not bulletproof. In fact, the fact that he is barefoot through the entire movie becomes a real impediment. And by the end of the movie, he looks like a zombie. He looks like he's from The Walking Dead. Yeah. He goes through it. And as an audience, we go through it with them. It also has, of course, the joy of being a lot of people's favorite Christmas movie. Some people call it Miracle on Nakatomi Plaza. And I can think of no better way to spend my holidays or any time with my boys than hanging out and watching Die Hard. So, again, once upon a time, a bunch of would-be terrorists, at least posing as terrorists, led by amazing actor Alan Rickman, seize control of Nakatomi Plaza and the one floor that was still occupied by a company celebrating their Christmas party. And John McClane is stuck in there with them, and he's got to save the hostages, and he's got to protect his wife, who they've been in the midst of a divorce, and the kidnappers don't know that she's his wife. They don't have leverage that way. There's a lot of things that he's got to handle all at once. He's in over his head. Die Hard, I think uncontroversially one of the greatest action movies of the 80s. Maybe controversially one of the greatest action movies on this list. So I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this, but Owen, what do you think of Die Hard?
It's pretty freaking sweet, if I'm not gonna lie. Something that I like, and to me this is the first movie that does it, is it has a character that does not heal throughout the movie. Every injury, he does the equivalent of he's losing HP, but he's not healing from it. He's just running through this. And he does, basically the movie goes through it, and he gains equipment but loses, gets hurt and roughed up. And every fight, he gets hurt, but one less bad guy to fight at the end of the day. Yeah. And it's one of those things where every time he shoots into a crowd and he kills one or two of them, that's progress being made. Because every time one of them dies, it makes the next fight that much more important, but also that theoretically
he's easier. Getting closer, yeah.
Yeah.
But, so it feels like he's working up the food chain, sort of. He is he would not be able to just rush in there and just gun down all of them, what other action movies would have done.
And at the risk of sounding like it was better in my day, he doesn't kill triple-digit people in this movie. This isn't John Wick, where it's like a video game. There's probably, 8 or 10 terrorists?
Yeah.
And he deals with that. Yeah. And that's enough. The movie feels full.
Yeah. And ironically, them having less terrorists make them feel like more of a threat because it's
each harder. One of them is a bad news too. Yeah. There's no weak link in that chain. You get
there's no stormtroopers to.
They're a well-oiled machine.
Yeah.
It also like makes it like every time he takes one of them out, it's that much more impactful.
Right.
And the terrorists feel like it's personal. One of them had a brother on the team, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And he starts to not listen to the main commander because he wants to kill the guy that killed his brother.
Yeah. And it's understandable. Hey, not only did he kill his brother, but he dressed him up as an ornament, right?
Yeah.
And one of the best line readings of all time.
Yeah.
Now I have a machine gun. Ho.
Ho. Ho.
Oh, that's just magical, you guys. Yeah.
Gee, I wonder what all our opinions of this movie is.
Well, I mean, it's one of the movies that's kind of hard to review because it's that iconic.
Yeah.
Like, when he wraps the fire hose around his waist and dives off the side of the building, that's iconic.
Yeah.
When he throws the body out of the side of the building to get Al Powell's attention, that's iconic. When he throws the explosives down the elevator shaft and they explode, yeah. When he's climbing through the vents, like, there's just no sequence of this movie that's not iconic.
It's so iconic that people liking Die Hard is a character trait in other shows.
That's like, right.
The show.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine? Yeah. Is that the show? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I get it. Bruce Willis was absolutely the man. At the time, he'd only done a couple of comedies as movies, but there was this TV show, Moonlighting, that he was in that was quite popular. But he just didn't fit the bill, at least according to the 80s, of your action hero. And after Die Hard, I can't even tell you how many action movies starring Bruce Willis have happened. Unfortunately, a lot of them are you know, not so good. There's some great ones, but Die Hard is clearly the best.
Yeah, Die Hard's like one of those movies where like you might, even if you haven't seen the movie, you know what happens there. Like the sequence of events that happens gets like repeated and like referenced in so much other media that
it's become a trope.
Yeah,
it's become, especially in superhero TV shows, bad guys take over a base and they turn the security against the main characters, and they have to crawl through vents and deal with it. That's a thing that happens because of Die Hard.
I also have great respect for the screenplay because there's no wasted space in the screenplay. Even stuff you think's weird. Why are we spending so much time with Argyle, the limo driver? Well, Argyle gets sort of locked in the basement and sort of is helpful towards the third act. The fact that he doesn't have shoes on actually plays an important part in the plot later on. The kind of asshole cokehead in the office who is one of the few people who knows who John is and why he's there, who thinks that he can negotiate his way with Hans Gruber. That's an amazing sequence because we kind of know how it's going to play out and we hate this guy's guts. But it's also a really good piece of writing. Over and above, it plays out how we expect it to. He doesn't spill the secret. I think he goes right to the end. He just says, oh, John's an old friend of mine. He doesn't say he's married to my boss. Yeah. He even gets a moment of grace. I also think that the whole movie is a little bit different without John's relationship with Powell over the radio, where they're always talking to each other to sort of gain support, and he's giving them the inside information. They become genuine friends, and there's this really weird, perverted sort of idea of a Christmas miracle because Powell could never draw his gun again because of an accident in his past, but through this adventure he learns to kill again. Christmas, you
guys. I see more of himself, like his instincts were wrong, so he doesn't trust himself to use the gun ever again.
But it's a big part of the movie, and that's the sort of another note that wasn't in a lot of the other action movies of this time.
Yeah.
Where else can we say about Die Hard? I mean,
it sort of did this thing that other movies did where, he's a cop, but he's a lot more realistic and human compared to most other people on this list of people. Like, cops exist all over the place, and what he's going through with his wife is a real thing that happens when two strong-headed people are trying to do two different things and aren't willing to move.
And I think really, other than him talking to himself and delivering a few one-liners that he can pull off because Bruce Willis was kind of made to play that kind of character, there's no thing where I'm like, that was really stupid.
Yeah.
Like when he sees them interrogating who is the name of the big boss of the company and threatening to kill him and eventually blowing his head off in front of John. Like, he at first admonishes himself for not doing anything about it, but then immediately corrects himself by saying, then I would kill it. If I stepped in, there was four guys in the room against me. They were all armed. It just wasn't going to play out. So he goes to an empty floor and he trips a fire alarm. Bring in help. Don't try to take this all on by himself. There's no point where it's like, this is on, or where there was a montage of him gearing up and just full-throated going into it.
I also do, like, really enjoy, like, he didn't immediately go, like, trying to take them out before. His first response was trying to get police or, like, anyone else here to deal with them.
Yeah.
Because he didn't think he could do it.
Well, and he's, like, not even really a cop in this city. He's a cop in New York, not Los Angeles. He even says, I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time, right? And fair enough. Yes, I think that the whole crew of the terrorists, their efficiency and their professional nature, again, they weren't, as you called them, stormtroopers. They were all allowed a bit of character.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who did all the computer stuff, he was kind of funny comic relief, but he was also pretty ice cold. You got the feeling, like, despite how he looks, no, he's got a military background. He's hard.
No, he was very much, I don't think he shoots anyone, but you very much get the feel that the only reason he wasn't the one shooting him was that wasn't the plan.
Right. Or just little human moments. Yeah. Like when they are gearing up to shoot at the SWAT team, the one guy steals a candy bar to eat while he's waiting for time to shoot the good guys. The posturing of Alan Rickman, like, part of it is the performance and the presentation for him. You get the feeling not only does he want his millions of dollars, but he really loves his work.
Yeah.
He's really enjoying himself. He likes playing the FBI or pretending to negotiate, or, like, he's just in control 100% of the time. There's a detail of the plot that's way too old. It was too old for me. He wants to be called Roy over the radio so they don't spill his actual identity and out his marriage. And Roy Rogers is this old cowboy, and that's where the Yippee-ki-yay comes from, and there was something that I didn't know that was pointed out in a bit of diehard trivia I fell in. The very end, spoilers, John McClane wins, and he shoots Alan Rickman, but he only has two bullets. He kills one guy, he fires the other one, and he says, Yippee-ki-yay, and then he blows out the chamber of the gun. He just blows the end out, and apparently that was sort of a trademark Roy Rogers move. Again, the detail in the writing. You don't have to know that for it to work and be awesome, but
it is cool.
Yeah.
There it is.
And, like, this movie does, like a lot of things, like, other action movies tend to struggle, like, those, like, quiet moments where there's, like, any overall action going on, like...
But you're not, like, bored.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what's he gonna do now? When he bumps into the Alan Rickman character... And they have that whole exchange where Alan Rickman's pretending to be American and just some lost guy in the building. And John hands him an empty gun. Again, smart. A good standoff. This is some pretty tough competition for the rest of the episode. Is there anything else you guys would like to say about Die Hard?
Just want to quickly bring up how smart both the good guys and bad guys are. And ironically, the thing that slows that, like... is the main problem is the FBI and police's textbook approach to every problem that goes on in there, which is how they can predict what their next move is, which ironically is only really a problem because Hans knows.
It's all part of his meticulous plan.
It's strategy as much as it is action. They're both sides are constantly trying to try something else to get the leg up. and not it's and it's never just Han sending as many people out after him at once to deal with the problem like that. It's always, we'll do this and we'll try and bring him out into the open or something like that. And yeah.
And yeah, it birthed a pretty great, mostly great, kind of, for the most part, franchise. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A good 3 movies. Let's go yeah. with that.
I would, might even go as far as 3.5. Are you good? Is there anything else you want to say, Tristan?
No, I'm good. Yeah.
He's the criminal's worst nightmare. A cop who enjoys the danger.
No guns, no jiu-jitsu, just bring him down.
Do you really want to jump?
Well, then that's fine with me. Come on.
Wait, what do you mean? Wait a minute. What the...
He was ready to retire. Now, he's going to wish he had.
Gun!
Raj, meet your new partner.
New partner? Oh, too old for this.
If these guys can just stand each other...
What you got in there?
Boyan Smith?
A lot of old-timers carry those.
The bad guys don't stand a chance.
We are sticking with the 80s. 1987, I want to say, Lethal Weapon. Richard Donner is the director. He did a little movie called Superman, which we watched not too long ago. He did a movie I really like called Lady Hawk, a horror movie I really like that called The Omen, and the cult classic The Goonies, amongst many other things. He made all 4 of the Lethal Weapon movies. This was the establishing one. And what we're riffing on here, which was very big in the 80s and early 90s, is the buddy cop movie. Mm-hmm. So we've got split focus between Riggs, the loose cannon, suicidal, crazy cop, and Murtaugh, the 50-year-old family man who's just trying to keep alive until retirement and, you know, make it through every other day. Not a risk taker against with somebody reckless and sort of the... mm-hmm. odd couple mechanics of that. So that's very familiar, having those characters, but putting them in an action scenario was a little bit different. And at the time, the idea that a white guy and a black guy would be best friends was maybe not controversial, but less commonly portrayed on the big screen. Mm-hmm. It was like a big deal. Even mental illness wasn't something taken particularly seriously in the 80s. And I think as far as 80s movies go, Riggs' suicidal tendencies are actually pretty well explored. It's harder than my memory of it usually was. I sort of almost thought of it as an action comedy, but when I watch it with you guys, it's a darker thriller. Mm-hmm. It opens with the woman messed up out of her mind jumping off of a balcony, and it's being the daughter of a friend of Murtaugh's who basically personally implores him to find out why this happened to the daughter, who did this and why. And at the same time, he's got to break in this new crazy partner. Also, coincidence to Die Hard, that happens to be set at Christmas as well.
Huh.
It's Christmas in L.A., but yeah.
It's a Christmas movie.
Well, there's a shootout at a Christmas tree lot, and when the car goes through Murtaugh's house, it knocks over his Christmas tree and all the gifts. Like, it's not a Christmas movie in the same way that I think that Die Hard is, but it is set at Christmas. Shane Black, the screenwriter, who's done a lot of great movies. He did one of the Predator movies and this movie called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and the Nice Guys. And some movies said, maybe I should show you because they're fun. He has a tendency to set his movies at Christmas or Halloween or some sort of a holiday backdrop to just sort of give them a little spice. So, this was the one when I was going to show to you guys, because it is considered a classic, that I really wondered if you were going to vibe with from how strong the 80s was and like where it fell back to. But you seem to have a good time with it.
Yeah.
You seem
yeah.
to agree.
Like, there were some like awkward moments, but like, yeah.
yeah.
Overall, it was an enjoyable experience.
Good.
I was kind of happy because I was sort of looking at this, and as you said, a white guy and black guy cop partner. I was expecting the white guy to be start the movie kind of racist.
Right, he has to learn some moral lessons.
And no, it was, his lessons weren't that, which I kind of was relieved by, just because I didn't want to be uncomfortable by this action hero-y guy.
Right.
Also being a jerk, which he is, but in different ways.
Yeah. He's self-destructive, which makes life difficult and dangerous for Murtaugh. So, yeah, he does really need legitimate help. As much as it might make him a super cop, it's not super awesome that he's willing to jump off of a building just to see if he feels something, right?
Yeah.
And it's that thing where he's going out of his way to... He's risking his life more than he should to get the job done.
Yeah.
But if he's this good of a cop, how many potential criminals is he letting out if he doesn't take accountability and try and prevent his own life? But I forget, do they ever go into I know they go into a little bit detail. Do they ever, like, straight up explain why he's...
His wife died...
Right,
messed him up. In the second movie, they get into specifically how and why his wife died, but we don't find that out here. Mm-hmm. But he's mourning his wife. He's living alone in a trailer on the beach, and he doesn't seem to be happy. Like,
yeah,
he's taking completely crazy, reckless risks, and is willing to put a gun in his mouth when Murtaugh dares him to do it. Like, again, it's a much darker movie than I remember. And as the series goes on, there's four Lethal Weapon movies. The movies do tend to get a little friendlier and a little sillier. This movie is the least of that to my memory. Like, it's quite dark, actually. Yeah. Gentleman who goes to Murtaugh to see that his daughter gets, you know, her case is solved. I'm just trying to find the actor's name here. Tom Atkins. He's a really famous kind of B-movie actor. And he's not a good guy. He's not exactly a bad guy. But, like, he's kind of in the middle. And you kind of expect this movie to end with him at his daughter's funeral, at least knowing what happened. But no, he gets gunned down in front of Murtaugh.
Yeah.
And it's kind of nasty. The villains... Gary Busey plays one of them. There's some crossover because he's also one of the bad guys in Under Siege. And interestingly, the bad guy who electrocutes Mel Gibson and is giving him all those shocks is also one of the terrorists from Die Hard. There's very kind of a lot of crossing over with all of these movies.
Must be an interesting resume for them.
That's right.
I was the bad guy in this movie. I was the bad guy in this movie. I was the bad guy in...
It helps the stakes that it plays it that straight until the third act. There's kind of a goofy fist fight that happens at the very end of the movie where, like, everything's resolved, all the bad guys are under the rest, and they take the cuffs off of him so he and Riggs can have a mano-a-mano in the front yard. While there's a helicopter circling, and considering how stupid it is, it's kind of crazy that, like, I still hold this movie in such high esteem. But I do. But it is way more character-driven. Like, when you think of this movie, what's the big action sequence that you remember?
The part where he's getting electrocuted and he escapes, and then that fight scene that happens after that.
Right. But, like, there's a mini shootout at the Christmas tree store, and there's, like, beats where there's, like, a foot chase or anything like that. But as far as, like, shootouts, action, explosions, it's actually pretty minimal.
Yeah.
But it's still considered this epic classic action movie. And I think that has to do with how much we like the dynamic of these characters. And I definitely know one aspect of the story that made both of you uncomfortable.
Oh.
Yeah.
You mean the really inappropriate, flirty...
The teenage daughter of Murtaugh is instantly smitten with Mel Gibson, who is dreamy. He's rocking that 80s mullet that was so going for, but you guys just were instantly made so uncomfortable by this.
Can you blame us?
Well, I'm just curious, like, considering all the violence that we're going to be subjected to in these six movies, why is this teenager having a crush on Murtaugh the most difficult thing for you guys to watch?
Would you like to start, brother? Please?
I'm just curious.
Yeah, like, I'll be honest, like, for me, like, just... It's hard to describe, but I'm all honest.
It just makes you uncomfortable, that sort of tension. Sexual tension.
We don't like romance and that ugly and that, like, oh man, I don't know what I'm going to say to her. Like, that especially makes me go, ugh. So, with that, plus the age weirdness, plus the relationship, this is your dad's coworker. What is going on here?
Well, not all teenage girls, and I hope this isn't controversial, make the best decisions, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. Or teenage boys. I didn't mean to be sexist about it.
Yeah. Men can make mistakes, too.
Yes, yes. Different, better mistakes.
Anyway. Why do you think we're here?
Ouch. Ouch. Punchline. Yeah. Tristan's knocking him off. So you didn't find the cliches too bad. I remember we had strong feelings about the soundtrack. Do you know what I'm talking about? A saxophone.
Oh, yeah. Just like randomly throughout the movie, just one saxophone just keeps on returning. And just like the saxophone man is following that.
Yeah, we had this running commentary about there's some dude with a saxophone just following these dudes around.
It's that kind of thing where it doesn't happen a lot in movies, but in TV shows, especially old cartoon, like not old, like you
older, old like me. No, not that
me
old.
Kid. Me as a kid, cartoons would often have like a trumpet or saxophone or trombone, like. Like little sounds going through when like they enter a room or they like just in general. So hearing it in a live action movie felt off and a bit like what? Why is this? Yeah. Like I was thinking like to maybe like turn into a song for the transition.
I don't have like clean answers for you, but the saxophone was huge in the '80s in pop music, in movies. It was, for a time, it seemed almost ubiquitous. And, but I think it feeds into this sort of vibe of these 80s movies. Like, yeah, the saxophone and the big hair and the fact that every room seems to be full of smoke and it's all grainy and it's got this tactile, kind of sweaty feel to it. I don't know. Because I grew up with that vibe, I really like it. I just sort of like associate good memories. It's like, I'm home, you know? But, it's interesting talking about Lethal Weapon because it is almost the cliche action movie too. It's everything you know it's going to be when you sit down to watch it, but it still works.
Yeah. It was so interesting, like, as we sort of mentioned, it does like take a while to get like the full on action. Like for a lot of this, it's like a lot more of like a detective style movie, like investigating things and like finding leads.
The first half of the movie, the tension is Riggs going to get Murtaugh killed or get himself killed until there's people who are really serious about it. I think what really leverages the stakes is when they involve Murtaugh's family, which we sneakily get to know them when Riggs comes over for that uncomfortable, albeit supper. But they really see this guy who's hurting and they basically accept him as part of the family. Like they are so good to him, so I think he like invests in that right away. So it's not just a matter of helping out his partner, it's intensely personal. When the teenage daughter is kidnapped, they were both like, oh it's going
we're
to get
going
bloody.
To kill these people if we have the chance.
Another 80s cliche, and thank you for bringing it up. This is definitely guilty of 1980s cops kill without remorse.
Yeah.
There's no reading anybody their rights. There's no winging or injuring the bad guy. Like, they murder people straight up in this movie. Yeah. It's kind of funny. What else? Is there anything else you guys want to say about Lethal Weapon? Have we covered it?
No, actually, I'm going to save that for the ranking part of the podcast, Tristan.
I'm good, yeah.
All right.
It was the thing that made Mel Gibson a superstar. He was big from Mad Max and Road Warrior. Mm-hmm. Another great 80s action movie. Oh, chef's kiss on the Road Warrior. But yeah, this made Mel Gibson until he eventually unmade himself.
It was the final voyage of America's mightiest battleship.
What's on this helicopter?
This little sweetheart. Miss July 89.
God, I love this business.
I love you.
The party was wild.
Love you to death.
They really knocked them dead. Imagine this arsenal of tactical nuclear weapons falling into the wrong hands. The Pentagon never did.
4 minutes ahead of schedule. Damn, I'm good.
Now, a team of terrorists have taken over.
Wake up the president.
But there's just one thing they didn't count on. The cook.
They're coming!
Are you
like some special forces guy or something.
No, I'm just a cook.
Oh my god, we're gonna die.
So we ended the previous review talking about Mel Gibson. Speaking of assholes, Steven Seagal is infamously one of the biggest idiot jerks in Hollywood history. He was given the keys to the kingdom. He was like heir apparent to the action, you know, throne. And he threw it all away just by being a jerk to everyone around him. And he still makes movies to this day, but in the early 90s, he was like top of the world. And now he's like Steven anything for a dollar Seagal. And he's kind of, you know, not in shape anymore. He's kind of entered the sad phase of his career. But Under Siege is probably the peak point for his career. This was the biggest movie and the biggest success that I think he ever had. And to be fair, I mean, if you didn't know that he was an asshole, I think he does the job in this movie. Like, he is the efficient action hero. It's directed by a man named Andrew Davis, and I bring that up because we've reviewed another one of his movies. Remember The Fugitive?
Ooh.
That was the movie he followed this up with. This movie overperformed so much that he was handed the keys to that prestige picture. And that went around and actually got nominated for Oscars. So it was very good for his career. The story here is that Casey Ryback was like the super military, secret, high-ranking super spy who was kind of done with his career, and he wants to ride out the rest of his time as a cook on this warship. And
who's the, like, captain is an old friend of his.
That's right. He's just playing out the rest of his. He's got a couple more years to play out before he can, you know, unhinge himself from the military life. And he's just hanging out, feeding the boys, trying to live the good life. And wouldn't you know it, gentlemen, a bunch of terrorists seize control of this warship, and they want to steal some nukes so they can start problems all over the world. Tommy Lee Jones, who would also play the pursuer in The Fugitive, is one of the main villains. And Gary Busey, who was one of the main villains in Lethal Weapon, is sort of the guy who facilitates. He's the betrayer, the guy who, like, gets them on board and causes directly the death of a lot of these soldiers. Thrown into the mix is a poor, innocent, young Playboy model, played by Erica Eleniak. I can't see her credit here for her name, but she was there to entertain the troops, but she fell asleep in the cake, and by the time she wakes up, everybody's been locked in the brig, and it's only she and Ryback who have to figure out what's going on and deal with the situation.
Wasn't she drugged? I think she was
She
given,
took some pills to relax herself, and I think it knocked her out. So, yeah, it's the setup, and Tristan said it just as before I hit record, is Die Hard on a boat. And I think that's both the good and bad thing about it.
Yeah.
Like, it pays off in a lot of these ways. Whittle down the bad guys. A hero that we can get behind. He's certainly not as relatable as John McClane, but, like, we like how much he loves and respects these military men, and he doesn't want to see any harm come to them. And, we know exactly how it's going to play out. I can respect how well it's executed, but it is definitely Die Hard repeated. It was like, that worked, let's do it again.
Yeah, and it's like, in its heart, if like trying to do something when you're being, like, doing things like this, you're going to be directly compared to Die Hard, which, yeah.
That hurts you right away.
All these moves are going to be compared to Die Hard.
Right.
I'm not just talking about the review, but, like, action movies, Die Hard's one of the big ones that's going to be compared to a lot of other movies. And I will give it credit, it did take some unique changes. Main one being that the main character is not alone in this.
Right.
He has not just, you just told us her name, but
Erica Laniak's the actress. I can't remember her character's name, but I can find that.
She's there, she's helping. He has friends.
Oh, she's Jordan.
Jordan,
her name.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of background characters are familiar, too, that you'll see. Raymond Cruz, Bernie Casey, a lot of faces. You don't necessarily know the actor, but I've seen that guy before. Another interesting thing about Under Siege and movies of its type is that if it does have a strong military component, if you want to shoot on an actual warship instead of, like, building one, you need to get permission from cooperation from the United States military. And that's a double-edged sword, because when they say yes, they also mean, but you can't portray us in any way negatively. Like, mm-hmm. I'm surprised even that they were okay with the Gary Busey character. Like, Tommy Lee Jones and his sort of side crew, they're not military. They're just outside, you know. Mm-hmm. He was ex-military, but they're not signed in. They're not true-blooded American heroes, right? And they factor that in. So, like, when he releases some of the guys at the end of it, there's this patriotic pounding your chest. And these guys know how to, you know, fire the weapon so they can blow up that sub and God bless America. And sometimes that can rub me the wrong way. Like, I can mm-hmm. see through it. They're just like, they're not going to let the military show their flaws. And in this case, in early 92, they actually kind of did. So we got the production values of a real military set without portraying the military as perfect, right?
So, what are some of these military flaws that you feel like they let them have?
Well, the Gary Busey character betraying everyone, mm-hmm. like having his captain executed in front of him and being very satisfied by that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a true villain, and he's a high-ranking so that sort of thing. Usually when you get military cooperations, it's a movie like Black Hawk Down or Saving Private Ryan or something like that, where they're going to portray them as absolute unquestioning heroes. And yes, some of these people are fallen, but it's a noble, you know, nobody's a coward, everybody's altruistic. And you can overplay on either side. How did you feel about Under Siege, Tristan?
It was good, yeah. Like, it's really fun, yeah. Like, I do enjoy, like, it does do things, like, that are different from, like, Die Hard, as, like, Owen mentioned, and also just, like, yeah.
I grew up with this show, and it was a terrible show called MacGyver. And I do think it brings that component for this, like, Casey Ryback has all these little booby traps that he sets.
Yeah.
He can build something really quickly and throw it in a vent, and then a few minutes later an explosion will happen. He does
make a lot of bombs.
Yeah, he rigs the microwave to explode at the exactly right time.
I thought he linked it to the lights.
Right, so when they came in, they turned the power on and it started. Yeah. But I like that. There's a little bit of, like, the Home Alone-y
in the
neighborhood of Home Alone kind of tricks that he plays to get through the situation.
Yeah.
Another thing that I have problem with Steven Seagal, and it's in this movie, is that he didn't like to ever take a punch or a hard hit. He'll get exploded, or he, like, when somebody was throwing the anchor over the side, they got a lucky shot and scraped his shoulder. But when it comes down to, like, the big fight between him and Tommy Lee Jones, he almost looks bored during the fight. Tommy Lee Jones just gets hit again and again and again and again, and then he eventually is really violently killed. And too much of that kind of kills the stakes. Not that we really think Ryback's gonna die, but we have to not believe that he's indestructible, or at least believe that he at some time has some anxiety or is worried about his own death, you know?
Yeah. And I do think another sort of thing that this movie does is ironically care more and less about these people than normal civilians, because these people were out having a party that they probably deserved. I can't imagine working on a military boat
being that easy. Yeah.
And so having that, like, party celebration of someone they seem to all enjoy or respect be taken away from them, and them being, like, basically used as a hostage to deal with our main character.
Yeah.
Is a thing that made me feel more, because they are nameless characters in a lot of different ways, but there are named characters, but, like, they are, like, the army, the navy people here.
They have some sort of built-in nobility because they've dedicated their lives to service. And again, in the wrong movie, that can get way overplayed, but unfortunately, the military apparatus is like any apparatus or any work community. There are amazing people, mm-hmm. and there are dicks. And that's just the facts. That's just reality. So, yeah, I think it's fun, but it's a weird one, because sort of like Die Hard, like, well, what do you say? Like,
Yeah.
Ryback works his way through the terrorists and things play out pretty much as you expect it to. But it's fun, it's energetic, it's well-paced. And I think, you know, 1992, it's aged pretty well.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's a little bit of a cringe factor to some of this.
Oh, I did have a small little detail. I liked that the female cast, the woman cast member,
mm-hmm.
is in this, like, sexy outfit at the beginning, and then once immediately things get serious, oh, she's not just running around in this, she gets covered up, she gets, like, she can't really wear, like,
yeah.
professional stuff, but they, like, get her what they can for her be helpful and stuff.
There's that moment of exploitation when she comes out of the cake, but yeah. Other than that, yeah, she gets dressed, they put a jacket on her, and she actually takes out one of the bad guys and gets yeah. Ryback out of one of the... So she levels up a little bit as a character. But again, do I believe yeah. them, like, getting romantic at the end? Like,
no, that was just kind of like... No.
That was like, this is how you end an action movie. He's saved the day. He's earned the kiss from the pretty girl.
Yeah. I actually would have thought it'd be funny if there was a sequel and it just immediately stopped. Like, right. just, it was all adrenaline from both of them. That could have been funny.
But I think the other thing I can say about this Under Siege and Seems to Girl, I showed you Commando, and there's yeah. a bunch of other Schwarzenegger movies that I'm happy to show you. I just showed you Total Recall. That was well written. And I'll show you Cliffhanger, and I'd be happy to show you some more Sylvester Stallone movies, because there's a lot of great Sylvester Stallone movies.
Mm-hmm.
With Seagal, really, this is the one. There's no other essential Steven Seagal movies. There's some that are okay, but this is the yeah. good yeah. one.
I was sort of in my mind watching this, comparing it, because I believe the last one we were watching was The Beekeeper of this guy.
The Jason Statham.
Oh,
that's
never
Jason
mind.
Statham. That's a different actor, no. Yeah, this is Steven Seagal. Is there anything you wanted to say about Under Siege before we close this one up, Tristan?
Nothing that comes to mind, really.
Okay. Yeah, that's yeah. all good.
Bruce got an emergency call at 5 climbers just ran off Combe Bluff.
I haven't climbed in months. You just lose the feel.
Maybe you mean the nerve.
Where's the helicopter?
What the hell's going on?
What are your names?
Tucker and Walker.
Well, Tucker and Walker, we're missing 3 bags. What's in them?
None of your fucking business! Fudge!
Where is the money?
From the mid-90s, Die Hard on a Mountain. Actually, no, it's called Cliffhanger. It does have a similar formula to the Die Hard structure and the terrorists that need to get whittled down. Mm-hmm. But I think beyond John Lithgow and Sylvester Stallone and Michael Rooker and the rest of the cast, kind of the star is the location, the setting,
mm-hmm.
does a lot of the work in Cliffhanger.
And it is interesting and... As much as we did just joke about it being Die Hard on a Mountain, the plot is very different in a way that the terrorists are not in complete control.
No, they're ever. Kind of on their heels
yeah.
quite a bit in the movie. Yeah.
Like, the only reason this movie really happens at all is because they messed up at the start. Like, yeah. They
lost dropped. Their money. They were trying to steal all of this money from a plane and hook it into another plane that they were mm-hmm. escaping, and the cargo is lost, and it falls over this mountain range. Stallone is this guy who was mountaineer, but at the beginning of the movie, tragically, his best friend's girl's equipment fails, and their attempt to rescue her doesn't work out. And what I actually thought is a pretty suspenseful Whoa. Sequence, and kind of a grim way to start the movie. It's a horror movie move. A lot of horror movies will start with everything's happy, hunky-dory, and they're living the perfect life, and then suddenly a terrible accident claims the husband or the child, and the rest of the horror sort of springs from that. but they're using it in a thriller context here. Mm-hmm. He feels betrayed, or he feels like he failed. His best friend feels betrayed, like it was somehow Stallone's fault that her gear failed. But he's got all this psychological damage set up so that when the money falls and the terrorists are on the mountain and they're hostaging the mountaineers to help them collect the money, and then will obviously kill them. There's no reason to leave living witnesses after getting the money back. But the elements are a real, you know, obstacle. They can't climb these big vertical walls. They don't know how to navigate in all of the snow and all the terrain. So, yes, Stallone has to save his former crew, redeem himself in his own mind, and step up as an action hero. And for Stallone, he kind of had a dip. He'd had some pretty substantial bombs behind this movie, and Cliffhanger was huge. And I think it deserved to be. I think it's a really, really solid action movie, and it's aged quite well. There's not a lot of stuff that makes you facepalm or go, that's kind of cheesy. Or even that's a terrible special effect.
Or even that stupid, even that beginning part where we're like, even when I'm watching this, like, come on, guys, get over this. I get why they don't.
Right.
He blames himself, and even if he knows there was nothing he could do, you kind of don't want to hang out with a guy that accidentally or like failed to save the person you love.
It would hurt the relationship. Yeah. It would cause tension, rightly or wrongly. And it would be traumatizing, rightly or wrongly, whether or not it was his fault, to see that woman drop out of your hand, literally, and fall to her death. And have a long enough fall that she would have time to think about it on the way down. Like, it's bad.
Yeah. And I can't imagine them finding the body.
That would be someone else's job. But yes, yuck. So, it's psychologically set up. He's not Ryback from Under Siege, where he's just this machine who gets everything right and is sure-footed at all times. And they shot in actual mountains. These aren't sets. And they got, you know, real great footage. And if you're scared of heights,
absolutely.
I think this movie will definitely get under your skin, maybe to a degree that might be a little bit too uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the better action movies of the 90s. I don't think it's in the same category as Die Hard, but it's in the conversation. What did you think of Cliffhanger, Tristan?
It's enjoyable. One thing I do enjoy is how they do showcase the sheer scale that the mountains are. Because, a lot of other things, they just, gloss over, but, it's huge. It takes them, the movie is, multiple days, if I remember correctly.
I think 2 days, fully, from start to finish. At least overnight once, I also think, we were talking about writing efficiency, especially in action movies. They do a really good job at making us like characters. There's these two stoner skier guys who like to jump off cliffs and pull parachutes. They only have a couple of scenes where we get to know them. But when one of them gets killed, it's that sucks. Yeah. The old guy who was the guy who would just operate the radio and was helpful to the mountain rescuers but was obviously too old to be on the mountain, he goes out of his way to come out and help them on the mountain. And he dies for his efforts. And when it happens, you're like, oh, that sucks.
This movie does a really good job about making me hate
the bad
these people. Like, there's doing evil for money and such. But the amount of effort and villainy they go through is not needed.
No.
It's that classic thing where it's evil for evil's sake. And it's...
Well, and I think that they lucked out a little bit with John Lithgow as the leader of the terrorists, because if there's any weak end of the screenplay, I do think it's him. He's just so, nobody would trust this guy as a boss. His evil is on his face.
To the point, I'm pretty sure, at one point, in order to make sure, okay, they can't betray me, he, killed the only other person who knew how to pilot a helicopter.
No, if you can't trust these people in this scenario, what made you think that in a professional heist, which is what you were doing before,
they wouldn't just kill you at the end anyways.
But that pilot that he killed, that woman, they were implied that he was actually in a relationship with her.
Yeah.
Not only did he do that to save his ass, but he did it ice cold. And she was, like, with him. They were together.
Yeah, yeah.
And just doesn't mean anything to him. And I'm not saying that's entirely unrealistic. A lot of sociopathic or psychopathic tendencies don't see the world in that way. But the people around him would know. Like, there's no way he's going to share this money with us. There's no scenario in which this ends without him murdering me. It's just nakedly on his face. But John Lithgow, I think, is having so much fun with it that we kind of just sort of roll with the punches that way. It's like,
especially when he's at the end, he was shooting that helicopter. It's kind of just...
I saw him interviewed, the actor John Lithgow, and he said during the fight on top of the dangling helicopter... Stallone fell over and I just raked his hand against a piece of jagged metal and they had to stop shooting. He had to go get his hand stitched up. So he's technically speaking, I won in a fight with Sylvester Stallone. Maybe not. Another fascinating bit of trivia, which I like to share on the podcast when we're talking about big movies, is at the beginning of the movie, there's a sequence where a man and a cable... He slides down this cable from one flying airplane to another flying airplane in this shot. Mm-hmm. And they did it for real. And apparently, lore goes is that, like, the studio was, like, looking into it, but the insurance on pulling that stunt off, they was just prohibitively expensive. So they approached this stunt performer, and he was like, give me $2 million, and I'll do it. And he did it. This is before largely CGI and stuff like that. I mean, Jurassic Park had happened, but this was not... it wasn't at that point where... Nowadays, the helicopter probably would have been entirely CGI, right?
Yeah.
So, hell, they could shoot the whole thing in a green room and probably convince you they were on the mountain range. But they shot it on the side of the mountain with real explosions and real helicopters. It also has a really memorable kill. Do you know what stalagmites are?
Yeah,
these weird spikes that hang down in caves. Some genius remembered, hey, somebody needs to get killed by one of those. And it's even better if it's not one of the ones on the bottom, but if he lifts them up over his shoulders and spikes them in on the top.
Honestly, like, all of the kills were, like, pretty good throughout this movie in general, like...
Hard R, brutality. It's not like people get shot and fall down either.
Yeah.
It's ugly.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing is the cold is a factor.
Yep.
He raids a museum house or something to get, like, this old wool jacket because he has to
have something. Yeah.
And he burns the briefcase of money for warmth.
Both for warmth and to piss off the villains.
If I was him, I mean, just, like, swipe a few.
Yeah, just,
like,
one brick of cash. Like, that's probably a year of your salary. Easy.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You've earned that. You've earned it. Stallone was big on doing his own stunts. I don't know how much is actually him. I'm sure not. But a lot of him dangling off of the cliff or in the ice water is the man. He is committed. And there is something to be said, and it's the same thing when I was talking about, like, martial arts movies, when you can actually see the actor's face as he flies through the air, or as he takes the hit, or as he throws the punch. You just, you get, when you watch enough of these movies, you can sort of tell, oh, we're cutting to the wide, so they can switch out for the stunt performer here, you know? Mm-hmm. And cliffhangers seem to really try as much as they can to avoid that. So... The director of this movie is Rennie Harlan, and he did a little movie that I showed you guys called Deep Blue Sea, which is a guilty pleasure movie of mine. I'm a fan. He used to be sort of a big-scale, high-budget director. He's still working today, but he's doing sort of more micro-budget stuff. But I always think famous filmmaker Quentin Tarantino said, if you can do action well, you're just a good director. And points. Yeah. Rennie Harlan. He infamously made this movie called Cutthroat Island, which was a movie that bombed so big it killed the studio attached to it. It was so bad that nobody touched the pirate genre for, like, over a decade until Pirates of the Caribbean. It was just
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
It was like infamous. And the movie is it's pretty meh, but I just didn't deserve that. It was just like, okay, everybody calm down.
I just imagine you're the guy that makes a movie, and because you made that movie, no one touches pirates for years. That's
the hilarious. World just said no to that movie. But no, I have a lot of fun with Cliffhanger, and again, it doesn't... A couple of the 80s movies, which I still call absolute classics, they're starting to feel their age. This movie still seems pretty damn solid.
And even the gripes I have with it, I understand why they have that, as we talked about the sort of psychopathic...
Yeah.
Just straight up evil, he's going to betray you, why are you thinking like this?
Right.
And the classic best friend hating you now because of actions and stuff. Right. I get why his best friend dislikes him now. It's even if you can like mentally understand that it wasn't his fault, like, it's still just that little bit of pain.
Michael Rooker is a great character actor. Yeah. You guys know him from the Guardians of the Galaxy's movies, the first two, Yondu.
Yeah.
But like, he's in so much stuff. I love The Walking Dead and Slither and a bunch of great stuff. I love that dude. And he's got some great moments in it. Mm-hmm. I always thought it was great, even when I was a kid. I remember seeing this in the theater when they shot the old guy, and I was like, oh, that sucks. As the old guy's dying, he slips Michael Rooker a knife. Like, he goes out like an absolute champ.
I forgot about that, yes.
Yeah. And again, another great character moment. So, if you haven't seen Cliffhanger, watch it.
And also, if you haven't, why would you listen to this episode?
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say?
No. Fun ice mountain movie.
Boom.
Hasta luego, fellas.
You're a funny guy, Sally. That's why I'm going to kill you last.
Are you going to tell me what's going on or what?
No. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired. What are you doing?
Helping you get her back.
Remember, Sally, when I promised to kill you last?
That's right, Major. You did.
I lied.
If it's a mission no man can survive, he's the man for the job. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Commando.
Let's party.
All right, Commando, we're going all the way back to 1985. Now, Arnold was a star. He had done this movie called Conan the Barbarian, which I am ashamed that I have not shown you yet. And then he did The Terminator, the first Terminator. So it is like, okay, he's on the radar. I think Commando is, again, the thing that solidified Arnold as this, like, superstar action entity. And no, he's not John McClane. He's not relatable. He's absolutely massive, ripped guy.
I don't know how tall he is, but in the moves, it feels like he's 7 feet tall, built out of muscle. Like this, he's like a Frankenstein of a human going around.
He's somehow a retired special forces colonel, but he looks like he's 30.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And he's got a 12-year-old daughter, which is the light of his life. But all of the former members of his squad are being hunted down and murdered, and a friend of his in the military in the know lets him know to be on guard. And of course, they're not good enough to get him, but they do take hold of his beloved daughter.
Dun,
and
dun, dun.
Man, does he ever open up a can of complete whoop-ass.
Yeah.
Now, I talked to you guys about 80s cheese, but this movie is like a whole new level of 80s cheese. And I love it, and I know you guys had a lot of fun with it, but I do want to like prepare people going in. If you didn't grow up with this vibe, there is some cheese, and you will have to accept the cheese. Like, action movies have one-liners. I think the 80s sort of birthed the one-liners, but like, most things that Arnold Schwarzenegger says in this movie is a one-liner. Please do not awake my friend. He's dead tired.
I mean, to be fair, like, if Arnold played a grounded character, I think that'd be more weird.
It's almost not what we wanted, at least not in this point of his career.
It was...
I just loved how this movie was a rampage. Yeah. It felt like...
Yeah.
And I liked it so much.
Accept the cheese and don't fight the cheese. I just want to lay that out first of all, because, yeah, no, it's a completely ludicrous movie. And there's a little bit of cringe stuff. There's a couple of actors in brown face in the terrorist camp compound, which is kind of strange, but like...
Did we bring that? I don't remember that. Were they just in the background? Or?
No, it's just like the Caucasian actor with dark painted skin and an accent instead of like actually hiring. Oh. Like it happened all the time. Native people were cast like that sometimes. And it's like there's weird things like that. And
how did I forget that?
An unfortunate product of the time. But you have to look past it. And the cheesiness of it. There is... no chemistry between him and Ray Don Chong, this woman who gets wrapped up in the chase. But that actually becomes kind of funny, too. Apparently, they shot a sex scene, but they just cut it out of the movie because it's good. Like, no, it just feels wrong. We're just not going for it. The bad guy looks kind of like Freddie Mercury, the lead singer from Queen.
He does.
And he's got this big mustache and these chains and this S&M gear, and it's got a sort of vaguely homosexual vibe to him.
It kind of feels like if you let a kid dress himself.
Does he want to kill this man? Does he want to kiss this man? What? There's a weird tension going on with Bennett. Let off some steam, Bennett. What happened to Sully? I let him go. Like, this is McBain, for real. Like, this might have, like, Commando is the movie that the Simpsons are commenting on with McBain. It's so ludicrously stupid that you kind of have to love it.
Yeah.
So, is it a good movie? Well, that's a harder thing to break down. Do I enjoy myself while I watch it? Yes.
Yeah. Like, for the things, like, we, like, mentioned, like, and how, like, a lot of the other, like, all the other movies on this is, like, more, like, grounded and stuff. When, like, a movie is, like, over the top, like, an action movie is over the top, it is insanely fun as well. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. When it's done right.
It follows its own rules.
Yes.
It's...
moment to moment. Yes. He can just climb out of a plane and jump out of the landing gear, and then let's just move on from that.
At no point do I feel like I'm being robbed of a scene because Arnold got hurt. It's always...
yeah.
Crazy BS happens.
Like, they only kind of follow the rules of reality when they kind of sort of have to. I appreciated that Ray Don Chong didn't take him at his word right away when he, like, pulls the seat out of her car and gets her to follow that guy and is super intimidating. Yeah. Go to the police. This guy's, like, seriously either crazy or up to no good, right? And so when she rats him out at the mall, you don't hate her for it.
No, not at all.
And, he literally... once upon a time, you guys, there were these things called phone booths. Because people didn't have cell phones. I don't know, what the hell are you talking about? So in order to stop Sully from calling the big bad and ratting out that he's not on the plane off to do his nefarious deed, he literally pulls this entire phone booth out and throws it across the room. And you're just like, wow. That just happened. That's a Superman moment.
Yeah.
That's
like, after that happened, didn't he get like attacked with like 12 security guards?
And he still gets away because Matrix can do anything.
He's still. Like, what was it that like they all like I think like four like a ton of them tackle him and he just pushes them all away at once.
And yet he gets away from them, but he doesn't hurt or seriously injure any of those guys because they're just doing their jobs.
Yeah.
But these special forces dudes, no. It famously, the final sequence, at the time it was like the most ludicrous body count ever, and then Stallone had to try and up the ante with his Rambo movies. But to me, it's not the ludicrousness of the amount of people he kills. It's just like, the openness of the effects. Like, there's springboards and air pumps that you can see people being thrown off. Or right before they cut to the wide shot of the building in the explosion, there's clearly dummies just standing in front of the building. And it doesn't fool me, but it makes me smile, like, every time.
It fooled me the first time I saw it. Like, right. the grenade one. The grenade ones I saw, but the dummies, no.
Right.
It's...
But yeah. Imagine, you guys, in the age of John Wick now, like, this was one of these won't-someone-think-of-the-children movies, too. Like, when he starts chopping off people's arms, or he takes those saw blades and starts throwing them, like, discs into people's heads. And why are children watching Commando? Which might be a fair question, but kids watch the hell out of Commando. Yeah. In small-town Alberta, like, I was 10, I think, when this movie came in that neighborhood. And Commando was... everything.
That is an awesome time to be Ted.
It was everything. Like, I can't even oversell how amazing Commando was when you're 10. And I do admit that I bring some of that love into it. Like, it's a goofy movie.
Yeah.
It just is a goofy movie. But I can't not love this silly, goofy movie. Oh, that's the chair making that weird
noise. I thought that was your phone for a second. Yeah, I was like, that's a weird...
Yeah.
What else can we say about Commando? It's dirt simple.
Yeah.
It's insane. It's funny. It's great. We have... You know what? How about Tristan and I just tell us one of our favorite scenes in it?
Please.
Would you like to go first, brother?
Remember when I said I would kill you last?
I lied.
I was gonna say that.
That's David Patrick Kelly is the actor who plays that part, and he is almost specializes in playing scumbags. And to his credit, he's good at it.
Yeah.
if you want an asshole in your movie, you can do a lot worse than casting him. What was your favorite part other than "I'd kill you last"?
You need to follow that car. Rips out the passenger seat and throws it to the side. There's no time to explain. Just do it.
I also like when she tried to help by firing the bazooka, but she fired it backwards. That was an amusing moment. Again, some cool actors in here. Dan Hedaya was one of the big bad guys. Vernon Wells, who plays Bennett, was one of the big bads in The Rogue Warrior, which is, like I've said already, just an amazing, amazing action movie. It's sort of the 80s version of Fury Road, right?
Right.
So, yeah. That definitely helps give the movie some personality. Alyssa Milano plays his daughter. Now, at the time, she was just a child, but she would go on to become this TV celebrity and kind of like a Teen Beat magazine sort of person of desire. So it's kind of weird seeing her so young because of how sexualized she is later in her career. But she's not sexualized at all. She's clearly just a kid in this movie that needs to be rescued. But it's just weird context when you know that about the actress later on. It's just the kind of movie that wouldn't get made today, couldn't get made today. It's locked in 1985, but I think there's value in revisiting it. Like, it's a fun, dumb movie, and sometimes you just want something that'll do all the work for you, that you don't have to think about. There's no mystery to solve, there's no challenge, you're not stressed out while you're watching it. Just watch Matrix kill some bad guys and get his daughter back.
It's a good time.
Right?
Yeah.
That's all we ask. I mean, the menu is, you know, there's a limited palette on the menu to choose from, but it delivers enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good enough?
Yeah.
You're deeply nuts, you know that?
All right, gentlemen, what we have here are 13 passengers in an express elevator. Bomb's already taken out cables. Bomber wants $3 million or he blows the emergency brakes.
Anything else that'll keep this elevator from falling?
The basement.
He can strike anywhere. At any time.
Will the mystery guest please sign in?
Why are they messing with me? Do they think I'm doing this for fun?
For L.A. cop Jack Travon.
Tell me again, Harry, why did I take this job?
Oh, come on, 30 more years of this, you get a tiny pension and a cheap gold watch.
Cool.
The game began.
Very exciting, Jack.
some close calls, huh?
When someone put the city of Los Angeles to the ultimate test.
Pop quiz, hotshot.
There's a bomb on a bus. Once the bus goes 50 miles an hour, the bomb is armed. If it drops below 50, it blows up. What do you do? What do you do?
Jumping back to the 90s, 1994, Speed. Starring you guys' favorite, Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
Now, he had done an action movie before this called Point Break, but it was a sort of shared kind of thing where he and Patrick Swayze kind of shared the screen time, and this was, let's make Keanu Reeves an action star. And he was Bill from Bill and Ted, and he's kind of playing these dopey supporting characters, like that show, that I Love You to Death, that movie I showed you. He's hilarious in that movie, but you wouldn't look at that guy and say, yes, action superstar. Yeah. And boy, is he ever an action superstar. But this is before The Matrix. This is before John Wick, you know.
And it's kind of fun to see him in this movie, knowing, oh, like, in this movie, he's like, this is one of his first, this is his second action movie.
His second action movie. He'd been making movies since the mid-80s, but this is, Keanu Reeves is going to be a star now.
And knowing what I know now as, like, a John Wick massive fan and who watched The Matrix in high school to write papers about it.
Right.
This, seeing him like this, it's almost like if, I feel sort of like how I see looking at photos of you as a teenager. Like, oh, no. What?
Who's that?
Why is, I can process how we got here.
But where's the beard?
But where's the...
Who is that? Who are you? Well, it's directed by a guy named Jan de Bont. He was known as a great cinematographer leading up to this. And he made this movie. He made a sequel to this movie, which wasn't as good. And he made a movie called Twister. And then he did the remake to The Haunting. And then he kind of stopped making movies. I think he did like a Tomb Raider movie or something like that later. But for a while, I was really wanting to follow his career, thinking, because the man did Speed, the man did Twister. He can do an action movie. And the writer, Graham Yost, Canadian. That's right.
Hell
that's
yeah.
Right, got the script sold on the initial premise of there's a bomb on a bus. Once the bus goes past, whatever, 50 miles an hour, it's armed. And after that, if it goes below 50 miles an hour, it blows up. And it's in the middle of Los Angeles. How do we deal with that? And, it's one of those movies that Hollywood noticed right away on paper. Yeah, this is going to work.
Yeah.
And it's not Die Hard on a bus, right? Yeah. It's not like the formula that we've seen a dozen times before. And it's very propulsive and quick. And that's what the movie was sold on. But over and above that, we have this amazing sequence at the beginning of the movie involving hostages in an elevator. So we get the first act to set up our heroes and our villain.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get the second act on the bus. And then we have perhaps the superfluous third act on the subway, which we can talk about a little bit later on.
Yeah.
But as a feat of action filmmaking, it rattled me when I saw it. I took my sister Tracy to see it at
the, I love this story.
Yeah, at the Place Riel Theater, which was famous, with its closed now, but it was famous for its sound system just being off the hook. And there's a sequence where the bus hits a baby stroller, and for a second you think they've just killed a child, but it's full of cans. It splashes down on the concrete, and we see all these aluminum cans go everywhere. My sister screamed so loud in the theater. It was awesome. And the movie is full of moments like that, of like, grip your seat, holy crap, what's going to happen next moments. You really get to hate Dennis Hopper, the guy who's putting them through all of this and watching it with indifference on all these TV screens. And the supporting characters, like Keanu Reeves was made into a superstar, Sandra Bullock was made into a superstar. A lot of the faces that you see on the bus, you would start to see more in other places. Alan Ruck, you may have recognized from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, mm-hmm. as Cameron. Like, well cast, well paced. Thank you for bringing Keanu Reeves up another full level. Like, it's an absolutely thrilling, literal, like, nonstop moving entertainment. It's so good that when it starts to get rickety, which it kind of maybe a little bit does in the third act, it's just too good to hurt the movie. It really, in the end, doesn't matter. You're just so grateful for the entertainment that you've been subjected to. So I don't know if it's coming across. I'm a huge fan of Speed. Yeah. I have the feeling you guys aren't going to fight me on it.
Mm-hmm. It's great. It's one of my favorite movies. It's clever. It's interesting. It's following that thing we talked about, Die Hard, where there's strategy and anticipation. The police know that he's in a bomb squad, yeah. Keanu Reeves' character. Jack Travitt.
It's a very, very cheesy action hero name, but I'll allow it.
But they talk about the bomb, and they talk about all these things, and ironically, Jack negotiates letting someone off the bus.
Yeah.
Which I thought was an interesting point, that this guy's a terrorist, but for the first time ever, we've seen a negotiation happen, because famously in action movies, we don't negotiate with terrorists.
Well, and Jack's cooperating to a point. Like, he, unbeknownst to Jack and the people on the bus, he's got a camera right there. So he knows Jack's not lying when he says this guy's shot. If we don't take him off the bus, he'll die. And the money man won't like that. He's just going to kill the hostages, right? He doesn't care. Whereas if he lets this guy off, maybe they believe he's going to free the hostages. But we know that this guy freeing the hostages is not a factor to him. He doesn't care how the bus resolves. He just cares how he gets his money.
He feels owed this money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a thing I enjoy is, like, he does with, like, the way he seems like, because he put all this effort in, he's entitled to it, even though, like, what he's doing is inherently messed up. Like, he was fully willing to kill a handful of innocent people. I mean, he, like, literally blew up a bus.
Yeah.
Just to prove he was serious.
Yeah. And he knew that, presumably, that was a friend of Jack's. Like, they seemed to have rapport. It wasn't just a bus driver to him, right?
He chose that bus because he chose to piss off that Jack was going to be the guy that paid for stopping his other bombing.
It's funny how a lot in this episode I've been talking more about the script than the explosions, but this is another case of really efficient screenwriting. Jeff Daniels, who plays his likable partner, who necessarily has to die in the movie, and it kills me every time it happens, but he has this running thing that he does with the Keanu Reeves character, with pop quiz hotshot, and gives him a scenario to play out. And the whole shoot the hostage thing is set up and paid off. He tells the story that that's how he would do it, and Harry gives him permission to shoot the hostage in that sequence. But, cleverly, we know that Dennis Hopper is listening to this entire exchange that they're having from the other end. They show him listening in. So, he incorporates that into taunting Jack. Okay, hotshot, there's a bomb on a bus. What are you going to do? Like, it's planted in there. And even throwaway lines. I've always loved that line where Dennis Hopper says, "There will come a time, boy, where you wish you never met me." And Jack responds, "Mister, I'm already there." That's not even a one-liner. That's just a great, like, response. Yeah. And the movie has an awful lot of stuff like that.
Yeah. The movie does a good job, like, keeping, like, the stress going, like, from, like, the moment, like, the bus, like, the bomb throw is, like, proven there. It was, like, cutting, like, the speedometer. It slowly gets to 50.
It's agonizing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's, like, these shows, like, how are they going to keep the bus at that speed? Like,
or stop it to slowing down. They keep on crashing into things. At one point, they lose a couple of wheels to spikes, and you're, like, they gotta keep the speed. But this is what I'm talking about, the movie being so good that we will buy anything just so the movie keeps happening. The big crux moment in this movie, one of the peaks of the action, is when there's a piece of the highway missing and they have to, like, clear this gap.
Yeah.
And there is no way in the world of physics or reality where this bus is going to clear that gap. Like, there's just no way. But it's like the audience wills it to happen. This is like... It happens, and it becomes satisfying anyway, despite it being ludicrous. The movie's just too good for that bus to stop.
Yeah.
I love it. Should we talk about the third act, then?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Or am I going too quickly? I don't mean to rush things.
I could talk about how I like the characters on the bus and how everyone's reacting. Mm-hmm. And we get to see a little bit of what's going on before the bus plot happens, where we see that there's like a tourist guy.
Yeah.
And she moves away from him.
He's a little irritating. I think he's well-meaning. Yeah. He's not like harassing her necessarily.
It's just like he's a chatty guy on a bus and she wants to not be chatted to.
No, and but they all have their parts. The woman who's really nervous about being on the bus and who ends up being booby-trapped off of the bus, we understand her. We don't like the choice that she makes, but we understand why she does it. It's all credible. The kid who sees this police officer running towards the bus and assumes he's there to arrest him for some crime in his past.
Yeah.
Like, unfortunately, that escalates the scenario, but again, gives another interesting dynamic on the bus. Ortiz, remember this guy? Who's just this big wall of men. He maybe has a dozen lines in the whole movie, but he feels like a complete character. Like, I think he calls him Gigantor.
Yeah.
Hey, Gigantor. And he says, Ortiz. Don't fucking call me Gigantor. Come on, give me a break, right? So right away, we're like, all right, Ortiz, my dude. The big debate amongst a lot of people is the third act of the movie. It really does feel like the subway sequence is the add-on. It feels like dramatically the movie peaks with the bus exploding and Sandra Bullock and Keanu Reeves shooting out again very improbably on this sheet of metal. And she has a little scratch on her leg, so it's all okay. Yeah. There's something about the subway line isn't finished, we're going to have to speed it up, and another big crash sequence at the end of the movie that maybe structurally undermines what came before.
Yeah. Like, they could have had the climax simply have just been the bus, because, you know, that's like
my the counter central to that, thing. Sorry. My counter to that is we haven't gotten any big fight scenes besides the beginning of it, that weren't just Keanu Reeves taking a massive risk to get this bus to work.
Well, and Thomas Paine needs to pay, right?
Yeah.
And him being arrested by a SWAT team or whatever, like him not getting his money at this point isn't enough, right? Harry is dead. Harry is not coming back, you guys. He killed Harry. So we got to see his head get taken off. And that is the one definite one-liner of the movie. I'm better than you. I'm smarter than you. And then his head gets smacked off. And Jack says, well, I'm taller. No notes. Yeah. But yes, the whole awkward exchange between him and Sandra Bullock, and then he almost looks a little bit embarrassed saying these lines, like, I know, I'll speed it up. Maybe it'll go off the tracks. Like, okay, really? Maybe it's going as fast as it can go right now, and hopefully, like, they can shut off the power.
Yeah.
Maybe no electricity, no stuff. Maybe there's an alternative to a gigantic explosion.
Maybe you can unclap, connect one of the train cars, and that'll do something. Like, there were other ways, and that give them an ending that doesn't involve them just, we have to go faster than fast has ever been.
And, the exhaustive explosion. Like, I had felt satisfied by the movie already, and it kind of just went on. But, I mean, if the biggest sin it commits is giving us a little bit too much. A lot too much is a problem, but a little bit too much.
Yeah.
And again, we needed that big payoff of the bad guy getting his. So I guess we couldn't just end with the bus sequence, or unless they were planning a sequel. But this is much more satisfying.
Yes, it is.
So I understand why it's there. I understand the criticism. It's valid, but Speed is still one of the best action movies ever made.
And it does have one of my favorite villain. The villain feels in this movie personal and logical in a weird mix of it, where, he has these feelings about, like, he's lost all this much, he's owed this money. But he's also very logical in the fact that, like, he's made different bombs, he understands everything he's doing, he's perfected it, basically.
Yeah.
That's his thing.
Yeah, like, I do enjoy the way, like, that, and, like, the guy's sort of, like, this clever mastermind, however, like, a bit of, like, kind of, like, I mentioned, like, this of, like, desire that he was, like, really entitled, that it seemed like when the money got, like, revealed, like, an ink bomb, which is, like, the most basic way to ensure that people who take money isn't
given. That's
like,
right.
He was so genuinely devastated. Like,
third act breakdown causing. Like, not the fact that his entire plan fell apart. It's that he finally got the money and it was stripped from him in an instant.
And that's when his intelligence vanishes. He's actually he's been evil, but he's been cunning. But at that point, all of his strategy goes away, and he's just going to kill Jack, and he doesn't even care how anymore. It's just like, this is the second time this has happened.
And he feels like a madman while doing it.
And he feels so superior to Jack. To lose to him twice is almost just like the last straw. He just can't handle it. I do think Sandra Bullock does deserve mention. She ends up driving the bus because the original bus driver gets shot. And she does add a really good ingredient to the movie. And I know you guys don't like kissy stuff, but I don't feel like you minded the romance in this as much as you do in some of the other movies. It's not explicit in any way.
Like, it's almost like just like comforting her through like a stressful moment. Like,
And they're vibing off each other, but they're not romancing each other because there's too much other stuff going on. And it's finally when everything calms down where they look at each other and all of a sudden the vibes are there. And again, if there's not good performances, good chemistry, or if it doesn't fit in the movie properly, that can really grind the brakes down and make things come to a stop. So, again, great screenplay from Graham Yost, great direction from Yann DeBont, impeccable casting throughout it. Joe Morton plays the head of the SWAT team, who's increasingly frustrated when they find out the gaps in the freeway. He yells over the radio, "Okay, everybody's fired, you're all fucking fired."
Yeah.
Like, he's also in Terminator 2. He's a really good character actor. It's always good to see him.
And I was like, after that, when I go to the airport, just, please tell me the runway is finished.
That's right. Again, not a huge important character role, but fully lived in and fully realized in both performance and screenplay. And I appreciate it. It's pretty been effusive praise here for Speed.
Yeah.
Is there anything else we need to say before we wrap this up and get to the ranks?
Before I take the wheel, I should let you know I got my license suspended. For what? Speeding.
Zing. Good enough? This is a tough list.
Yeah.
Like, come on. Like, even the bottom of the list, there's no weak entries here. Yeah. Like, I recommend all of these movies if you're looking for an entertaining escapist action movie. Yes. Yes to all of these movies. It is me forcing you into the position of ranking these movies. I apologize again, but rank them you must, or else you're grounded. So, Tristan, what was your least favorite, I guess, of these six action spectaculars and
like,
why?
Again, like, as you mentioned, like, none of these I would consider, like, terrible movies.
Right.
Like, the one I put at number six was Lethal Weapon. Just, like, it didn't really, like, just hit the same chords as me. Because, like, again, it's, like, it wasn't too action-oriented. And, like, the detective stuff is, like, though it's there and is somewhat interesting, it's still, like, not quite enough to, like, fully invest me more than some like the other ones on this list.
I get it.
Yeah,
it's got the least amount of action of the action movies. Mm-hmm. That's a case to be made for sure.
Yeah. The next one, like, and like these are like most of these are like fairly close. Is Under Siege, like very fun, very. Like, had good moments, however, it was, like, the ones above, it just had, like, more I enjoyed and just good.
More going on.
Yeah. 4 cliffhanger, just, yeah. I'm gonna just be repeating myself.
Fair.
Yeah. Moving up, like, number 3, Commando is, like, dumb, fun movie, plus, like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Strong showing for Commando.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like...
And so, now we come to it, don't we?
Number 2, Die Hard. Yeah, like, yeah. This was, like, very...
It's true. Not easy.
Yeah. But, yeah, like, just... Like, Die Hard, like, my husband, because, like, this year, like, we've watched Die Hard more than Speed, I'm willing to say. Like, yeah, so that's...
At least once a year, it feels like there's time for some Die Hard, doesn't it?
But we watched Speed a good... We rewatched Speed a good amount.
But, yeah. And, like, yeah, number 1, Speed, just, like, yeah. You can tell, like, when we were talking about, like, we had little to no real complaints about it, so, yeah.
Even the, quote, bad spots were great spots. It's just like, yeah, where to begin? That's a good list. Again, I can't fight with you on that list. We don't have the same list, but again, fair.
And these are your era of movies. That's right. Me and Tristan were born well after all of these, I believe.
I grew up with these. You were subjected to them by your belligerent, abusive father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I make them watch it like a... Like a Clockwork Orange style, where I force their eyeballs open and give them eye drops. So.
Yeah.
All right, Owen, it's your turn, man.
Okay. Tristan, I forgive you. This was a hard... I had to... When writing this list, Tristan, in between recordings, mentioned that he changed his mind mid-move. And if you ask me in a week, this could change... But I'm pretty confident in this list, except for the top two. At number 6 is Under Siege. It's the kind of thing where, like, it's a good movie, but I feel like it's the one where I could predict how the feeling and how everything goes. I was never going, like, oh my god, that's awesome, as much as the other ones.
Right.
If you, like, paused it every half a minute, I could probably predict the next minute.
Right.
And that's not a fault. I could also probably have predicted other movies as well of this.
But you felt it the most watching this one.
The expectation of an action movie, which is both a blessing and a curse, is strongest here. After that, I have Cliffhanger. I like this movie. I like this movie a lot, but it is also just the unrealism. Like you mentioned, how, like, you can sort of take away some of the unrealism of just the straight up evilness of these people, and why would anyone listen to them? They're going to kill these hikers, and they're gonna...
It's true, since it's taking itself so seriously, that stuff sticks out more. Whereas in Commando, you can kind of let go of the cartoon aspects, right?
But I do like it, and it's always powerful when these villains that are motivated purely by greed, and the character does something as simple as burning the money they're after. That feels... that when I saw that on the projector for the first time, in my head, I thought, hell yeah. That's good. After that, I have Lethal Weapon. I was surprised that Tristan put this one at dead last. You put that one at last, right? Yeah. I do get why. I assumed you'd have it lower. I'm a huge fan of mystery and, like, detective stuff.
That'll help, yeah.
I listen to a lot of audiobooks that have detective mystery aspects. Hercule Poirot, Dresden Files, a lot of stuff. So, to me, the detective angle, I liked a whole lot more. And sort of the character work, especially, I liked. This character that wants... Like, if a cop dies in an action movie, I think he went out doing his job. It was his duty to do this. I felt like if this guy died, the movie would be worse for it.
Right.
Like, even if he died last minute, saving the daughter's life or doing something like that, or even if anyone died for anyone.
The movie was about saving Riggs more than it was saving any other character, right?
At number three, like Tristan, I put Commando. Great time, great lines. I enjoyed it so much that I was quoting it to one of Dad's friends. And it was just one of those moments where, like, it's one of those things where it's referenced so much in media, and now that I've watched it, I can feel those references more.
You're in on the joke.
Yeah.
And here we go. I think I know where you're going on this
one. Copy my joke, little man. At number two, also Die Hard. Wait, do you have Die Hard at two?
Yeah.
Two is Die Hard.
Oh, wow.
It was a hard pick.
I thought you were admonishing him for putting Die Hard in number two. Okay.
I did, because I felt insulted that he did that, even though he had to. It's really neck and neck. I think, like, if I were to, like, memorize, like, each aspect of each movie, Speed, which is one, wins by a tiniest of bits.
Yeah.
My only real feel like negative opinions about Die Hard is that it cuts between all these things, and at my first time watching it, I feel like it's taking time away from our main character, which I don't feel after a rewatch, but that's how I felt the very first time I saw it. And my only other gripe is that it was so good that they could not let it die, and they made sequel after sequel after sequel.
They diluted it.
The first three were good, but...
Well, it's a good thing you haven't seen Speed 2, because it's ass. I hate to report that, but it's just a fact.
Speed on a boat.
Yeah.
What could... Oh, you know the road? Yeah, what if it was everywhere and you were likely nowhere near another boat, realistically?
Somebody asked themselves, what if we did Speed, but stupider?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Speed at one, I mentioned, it's one of my favorite movies. I don't have a favorite movie, but this is... I love it. I love the risk. I love how... It's one of those things where, like, Die Hard has a crazy collateral if the bad guys win. If this bad guy wins, two buses of people that isn't fully crowded die. It's a tragedy, it's bad, but it's more personal than the world or everyone in this town will be sucked into this sinkhole, or, like, less people's lives are at stake, and everything about this is personal.
Yeah.
And I love it for that.
Well, again, I'm not going to fight you on the list. I think that the proof of what we keep saying about the quality of all of these movies is that all three of us have different lists. There's no matching, there's no 0 for 6, mm-hmm. there's no 6 for 6. But mine is a little out there different. I put Under Siege in last place. I like Under Siege a lot. The reason I think I'm putting it there is that I think Ryback is the least relatable and least engaging protagonist that we have. Mm-hmm. Like, even Matrix from The Commando has some sort of goofy vibe going on where you just kind of...
And,
like,
he's a dad.
Yeah, he's got really clear motivations. And,
yeah,
like,
we expect you to do this for us if we ever get kidnapped by some military guys.
No one's messing with my voice. Yeah. They're opening up a whole can of worms to do that. All the way in fifth place, I put Lethal Weapon. I like Lethal Weapon a lot, but of the action movies, as we said, I think this is the lightest on the action, but maybe the strongest on the characterizations. Mm-hmm. We like and know Murtaugh and Riggs, and we're cheering for them by the end of the movie. And yes, please, let's watch the sequels. And I think you guys should probably at least watch part two, because it's bonkers. I think you'll like it. In fourth place, I just couldn't quite get it to third place, you guys, but that's where Commando shows up. I like it a lot. I like it a lot, but it's goofy. It's a goofy, silly movie, and I think Cliffhanger has that edge where, you know, I really felt things more. I wasn't laughing at the movie. I was emotionally with the movie. Like, the bad guys pissed me off. I liked the good guys, you know. When people got killed off, it stung a little bit. The stakes really worked. And I just liked the whole setting of putting an action movie on the side of a mountain. I just think that was a good idea. Not an easy movie to make, but a really fun movie to watch. Cliffhanger doesn't always get mentioned in the same breath as some of these other movies, and I think it deserves to. I think it's really good. It made it to third place, but it ain't easy. Here's the part where I break your hearts and put Speed in second place.
Dad.
They stop talking to me. Oh my goodness. Speed is an action movie functioning at the peak as it can, especially in early 90s. And the early 90s, well, the 90s in general was just an amazing age for action movies. I want to default say that Speed is the greatest action movie of the 90s, but Terminator 2 and The Matrix also came out in the 90s. Like, the reason I'm putting Die Hard at number one, I think, is it's the iconic action movie, and it's the action movie of the list that changed action movies.
There were action movies
before Die Hard, and then there were action movies after Die Hard. It reinvented and reinvigorated the genre. And I can watch any of these movies multiple times. I've seen them multiple times, but I honestly don't imagine ever getting tired of Die Hard. Like, I didn't watch Die Hard this Christmas, but pretend I had. And now it's like the end of January. If I had a guest or met somebody who hadn't seen it, I would happily sit down and watch Die Hard. It's one of those movies like Tremors or something, or Ghostbusters, that I can just watch. I can just watch it. You want to watch Tremors? Right now, let's do it. Let's watch some Tremors.
Like a normal person.
Well, I one day kept these guys home from school so they could watch some Tremors with me. Yeah, we didn't agree. I'm not mad at you guys, and I hope you guys aren't mad at me.
Just a little.
Tiny bit. My dudes. I keep calling you my boys, but yeah, I know you're all grown up, but you're my boys. Mm-hmm. Deal with it.
Yeah.
Is there anything you guys would like to say to the people on the internet before we sign off on this episode of Rank and Review?
Watch action movies.
And give the gift of action to your children.
Oh, and if you have the internet, watch the beginning bit of Ace Ventura, the second one.
When Nature Calls,
where they fully do the beginning of Cliffhanger.
With a raccoon.
Yeah. I have that saved onto a playlist on my account. Of just funny things that I want to rewatch. It's so funny.
There is indeed something funny about Ace Ventura 2. See, we learned something today.
Yeah.
That's edutainment. All right, boys, now get to work.
Yes, sir.
I don't know, the great philosophers will debate, you know, what was the great action movie, you know, Die Hard, Speed, Terminator 2, does Aliens count? What was the greatest classic ultimate action movie? But boy, do I think that my boys and I gave it a good swing this episode, and I would love to hear your feedback. Send your ranks to rankandreview@gmail.com, and, you know, check out the YouTube site. Maybe throw some love and some likes and some comments there. That's always nice to hear. Maybe you think about checking out our friend Jason Dubray's show, the Shelf Shedding Movie Show. He certainly knows what he's doing, and he's been ever the supporter and regular guest of Rank and Review. So I hope you enjoyed that exploration of classic action, and I hope you continue to listen to Rank and Review. It drops every other Wednesday. You can go ahead and tell that other movie fan in your life. This has been the voice of your host and random Canadian, Larry Parsons. Thank you for listening.